This is CIUT 89.5 FM, the University of Toronto Community Radio Station, broadcasting live 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from Heart House, University of Toronto.
Listening to the Vibe Collective. This is CIUT 89.5, and we are alone in the studio. We have Jam and Kemba are both at the Making Noise Media Camp, I believe it's called. I can't hear myself either. Anyway, so. Yeah, so we're alone in the studio. Here in the studio with me is
Adrian Worrell.
And anyway, we're sort of on a freestyle vibes, and we're going to just kind of go through the week. Yeah, we're just going to have a few freestyle vibes. And yay, who came in on time, actually, in his world. but anyway, Adrian, you had a group of things that you wanted to talk about.
Well, it's been a pretty interesting week in a number of regards. One of the stories that it really blew my mind, but it was something that really gave me a moment of pause. It was a situation in York Region involving a police officer. I don't know if you guys heard this one.
No.
So apparently a black police officer, African-Canadian police officer, is called up to a disturbance someplace in the nether regions of York Region. And it's a farm party, primarily, I guess, you know, European young people. And he proceeds to kind of like break this party up or whatever. And he's subjected to racial taunts, things like, I'd love to see this guy swinging from a tree, like all these kind of like comments. He apparently pays it no mind and just goes about his job. I think there was a situation where he allegedly pushed someone's jacket into the mud or something. And so anyhow, this person sees him a few days later and wants to file a complaint against him. He's with it. He's like, okay, well, sure, no problem. This is my badge number. Here's my card. There's the police station. Just go ahead and file this thing. And so I don't exactly remember what happens from that point in, but somehow an independent investigator is brought in, and the whole situation is investigated. And it turns out that he is then charged with neglect of duty for failing to investigate the racial taunt against himself.
As a lawyer, like, what does that even mean?
Well, the resident lawyer. Not a lawyer. Legally trained. But the indignity doesn't come from any amount of legal training. It's just more that, I don't think that's got a lot of legs. Personally, it's because I suspect that cops don't have to act on every breach. So, for example, if they see someone jaywalking, you don't have to act on it or else risk being in trouble with your job. However, it depends on the severity of the crime you're letting slide. So in this case, if it's a very severe issue to racially mock a police officer and he doesn't respond to it, the extenuating circumstances would have to come into play as well. So if he's like, well, there were 50 of them and there's one of me and I don't want to have a mob situation on my hand when they're already saying stuff like that, I can see him having a very legitimate reason not to escalate the situation, especially when he's there to kind of shut down their fun. And they're already hostile. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly. But it's interesting that it would kind of go down the way that it did, and he'd actually be charged.
Right. Right. And what you're seeing is probably, and I'm glad it's blown up and it's become a big case, because these things sort of need to be brought to the fore, and people need to see how ridiculous some of this stuff is and the way it plays out. Actually, in my book this week, I've been following the Bradley Manning case, and that's been also kind of interesting.
Fill us in a bit. I'm a little bit sketchy on the details.
So the long and the short of it is about 3 years ago, Bradley Manning, who was posted in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and he was in the intelligence corps, decides to leak some documents to WikiLeaks. And a lot of these documents make the U.S. armed forces look very bad, like sort of images of the most memorable of them being was a video of a gunship shooting civilians. I think it was a reporter who got killed in that particular video. And he apparently, in his testimony yesterday, I believe, day before on Thursday, he said that he had attempted to go to the New York Times and to the Washington Post before then giving it to WikiLeaks, because neither of them wanted it. And what you have also, what you see there is this kind of complacency of the press in the sort of military-industrial complex as well. Mm-hmm. Like you'll see, for example, that like CNN recently was taking money from the Qatari government not to run certain stories on the uprisings that were taking place and the oppression of the Shias there, in particular, the Shia Muslims.
So they basically got caught being more or less taking a bribe.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not so much a bribe. It's expansion opportunities in media and there. And they're like, and then whether or not the regulation, the bad part of the regulation is if they don't run the story because there's pressure from an outside government. But it's self-regulation if they don't run the story because they know it's bad for business. So
I see.
Self-regulation, okay. Coercion, not okay. So this is okay for the press to say, we're not going to publish stories on that because that's a lucrative market for us that's coming up.
Hmm. And just a little financial coaxing or encouragement to recognize that it's going to be a future lucrative business.
That sort of self filtering process is usually how it's done within the corporate media, right? Like that's commonplace.
Yeah. And it's it makes me, I don't know, I always feel really sad when I hear about stories like that, because when you read all of those like sort of classic reports of how Nixon got thrown out of office and stuff like that, it was just darn good journalism, you know?
Yeah, would that even happen now? I don't think so.
Well, it's happening because of groups like WikiLeaks.
Well, on the net, I guess, yeah.
And it's sort of, but again, Julian Assange has been living in basically a prison. Although, I mean, it's a nice prison, it's an embassy, but he can't leave because he will be arrested and extradited.
So he's exiled to embassy.
Yeah, he's stuck.
It's the Ecuadorian embassy, correct?
I believe so, yeah. And I think he's been enjoying his stay there. He keeps saying how comfortable it is anytime he does a free speech talk or something. But at the same time, WikiLeaks, I think, is critical for the maintenance of democracy, because when the press fails, in which we see constantly that it has, right? When you have to sell papers, it's already a problem because it's a commercialized interest.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually remember when I grew up, state radio was a really big deal. And I understand the problems of state radio, but the problems of something – but like NPR is much better in the U.S. than any other radios, most news sources available, just because they give it to you pretty straight. And Democracy Now! Is also like another one of those ones that people really champion, and that's on CIUT as well, is that it kind of gives you the straight dope and not – it doesn't kind of – it's not – commercialized interest in the same sort of way that a lot of the corporate media is.
Mm-hmm.
Like selling slots on CNN was more expensive than the Super Bowl after September 11th.
Wow.
And that's
yeah,
crazy.
Because everybody's right? watching CNN. Yeah.
Right. Hmm. And that, of course, shapes the way that they present the news to you because they want to create down the line future, you know, draw eyes so that they can sell advertising. Like that's their primary business model. And what they report would be secondary to that goal primarily, I imagine. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge distorting effect.
I kind of like run into like CNN, whoever else is watching it, and I accidentally start watching it. And now they were talking about this case, and they always have like a crime of the week. Like they follow a court case like constantly until that's end or, you know, until it kind of dies down. But there's this one woman who killed her boyfriend. And it was on, like, the whole court case was on, like, 24/7. I didn't really kind of watch it, kind of just glanced it. But I find that with CNN, that's what they do. They mm-hmm. follow, you know, some kind of disaster, and they have, like, a court case. And then they have, like, sort of, like, you know, the fiscal cliff kind of news. You know what I mean? So it's interesting.
And especially, like, this week with the sequester that's now in effect in the U.S., and the automatic budget cuts and stuff that have hit and all of – so that's been the other big story. Like I just – let me finish up on Manning first. So the main issue is he blew the whistle on what he thought was an escalating conflict, and he wanted American people – in his words, he said he wanted the American people to see the real cost of war. But from a hierarchical military perspective, he disclosed state secrets, so he might be in a lot of trouble. And I understand that it's the protecting whistleblowers is quite different when you're protecting a whistleblower in a corporation and you're protecting a whistleblower in the army.
Yeah.
And I realize that those differences are probably quite significant. And so he's getting a sort of military tribunal instead of a proper court and what have you. And the procedures will be quite different. The penalties will be quite different. And so I applaud him for doing what he did without anticipating the kind of protections that a whistleblower elsewhere would get. But, yeah, he's going to face jail time. And I don't know if that's right or wrong because it's – people are saying that, oh, he should be protected because he was pointing out malfeasance on the part of armies. But that doesn't excuse you from disclosing secrets.
Yeah, not so much. And it's, you know, when you sign up to the military, you're subjecting yourself to a very different set of rules. You're no longer a civilian in that sense. So,
yeah, endless respect for what he did.
Oh, yeah,
but there are going to be consequences. But at the same time, he doesn't – his name doesn't deserve to be dragged through the mud.
No, certainly not.
But the issue is, and the kind of what the point that a lot of people are pointing out is that he exposed torturers and murderers and people who were doing really horrible things, and especially this culture of no accountability in the military. Like he was blowing the whistle on that. And at the same time, he's the one who's going to face jail time, and none of the people who he called out.
Well, there is accountability, right? It's like, it's going back to the what we're talking about before, it's like how these accountability measures are used selectively and almost perversely in this kind of service. Like, so the things that people often, you know, fought very hard to get in place to some degree are the same things that are now being used to punish people of that same kind of mentality or spirit.
Well,
you know?
We saw this playing out with the Idle No More movement and how it became about accountability for taxes and the mismanagement of funds became the kind of battle cry of people attacking the Idle No More movement. But the issues are quite separate, right, in many ways. Like, sure, there might be high moral quality issues that might be raised if you're like, oh, you allowed this mismanagement, but when the federal government is doing it, you want to take a stand. But at the same point, that they're kind of unrelated.
Yeah.
And in the same way with Bradley Manning, these two things are unrelated. Like his malfeasance and the malfeasance of these officers. But I think we would feel a sense of more justice if both parties were getting prosecuted.
Right.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
So
that kind of leads to the point that you wanted to talk about that. Was it MP?
Oh. Oh, yeah. Tom Flanagan. Did anybody see this? You guys just said not with Tom Flanagan?
I'm so bad with the news, unless I find – I have like my 5 or 6 target authors who I'll read every week. And then if they haven't written about something, I don't know anything about it. Well, so please enlighten me.
Well, I know the name. I'm not that familiar with Tom Flanagan's work. But apparently he's written some type of treatise on First Nation – relationship between the state and First Nations in Canada that supposedly it undoes the politically correct rendering of that history. So it's kind of like, if you read between the lines, it's like a kind of like conservative neocon type of revisionist history in a sense. And so he apparently made a statement saying that watching child pornography isn't such a bad thing. In fact, it's people's rights shouldn't be violated. Personal liberty shouldn't be violated just for because of their taste in pictures. And
so here we have again two relatively unrelated issues, but it weighs against the quality of a man. I think if you're going to put yourself in the camp, it's like these native issues. They don't really know what they're talking about. And let's look at some kitty pictures on the side. Like, come on.
More or less. It's kind of – and it's like that kind of ideology taken to the nth degree where it's kind of like any kind of infraction of my personal liberty. And it's kind of like, do you really know what you're saying? So he just kind of went ahead and he actually defended it too. Like people like – you just said, he's like, yeah, well, and he backed it up. So he kind of dug in opposed to saying, I made a mistake. And it's just the idea to me, I found it disturbing hugely. One, that he has a complete disconnect between the consumption of something and the production of something, and like how many of us do a similar thing, like shout out to my vegans out there. But, it's like people who like me who eat meat, for example, and like what we're torn up about the environment or whatever the case is, and don't see the connection between this particular practice, and everything that leads up to it. Similarly, with that mentality of like, oh, well, it's just looking at pictures, but it's kind of like, well, how are those pictures used? How are they manufactured? All these things are part, that's the actual problem. And it's so this kind of.
And creating a market.
Creating a market. So it's really that disconnect and the fact that he was so confident to just dig in rather than say, that was a horrible thing for me to say, or do I really got to take some time to think about it? Just kind of nonchalantly like, oh, yeah, explaining it away. So it's kind of, I wonder how something like that is able to happen with someone who's,
Well, I mean, let's look at the Catholic Church right now. So,
That's more again like a culture of no accountability, right?
Right, and, like for a long time too.
Right, and what was worse in those cases were this there was also a culture of covering it up, which is the thing that people. And that should be in everyone's bonnet. It's just that it's not only that these horrible atrocities were taking place, but that the energies of the church and the monies of the church and the monies of people who pay into the church were spent protecting these people. Like that's obscene. And in these other cases, like something with you have this kind of thing. I see this a lot with at least intellectuals or just smart people in general, right? Like they'll pick an issue that's just so heinous. And they'll want to frame a defense around it that wants to play very heavily on just logic. And they're like, on just based on hard logic, doesn't it make sense to you? Like man is an animal, we are beasts. Like this is a hard logic-based argument. And then on the other hand, you're sort of like, you're insane. When you're looking at these people, you're like, you have become so disconnected from the everyday reality of what – or from systemic thinking – because I find the only way to justify something like child pornography is to speak in terms of absolute abstractions. Like you could, if you're now start talking about how the Greeks may have lived and the cultivation of a certain culture or pedagogy that was delivered through penises and things like that. Like I think that's ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. And I think, like, for me, child pornography and child exploitation remains like a kind of the baseline of like thing, the lines you don't cross, you know.
You would think on the least, but I guess it's that kind of a certain type of arrogance and nonchalance. It's like, well, you know, I could say and do what I want because of that very culture of non-accountability or no accountability. Mm-hmm. Like, what's really going to happen? You know, and true to form, I mean, he said these things, and it's pretty plainly, you know, across the line. And people have, you know, people have run to his defense, you know, saying it's, well, the attack on him is cruel and unmotivated and or politically motivated. And it's kind of like, yeah, but he also said it's okay to look at child porn pictures.
Yeah. Well, I find the culture of defending our monsters or our bad people is quite interesting, because I just, for some very odd reason, I just got caught on this reading a web of histories of these different serial killers, because a friend of mine referred me to a book which was about a series of serial killings that took place during the Chicago World's Fair in the 19th century, end of the 19th century. And so I just kind of interested, and I found overwhelmingly that a bunch of these like sociopathic serial killers were also kind of embedded in their local communities and stuff like that. And they were good people for the most part, right?
Except for the serial
murder
and
torture. Except for the serial killing, yeah. Yeah, outside of that, real cool dude.
Yeah, and when the events actually start, there's this community upswell of people defending this person. And you know, when the bones and stuff start coming out the backyard, when the journals start showing up, when the pictures start showing, it's sort of, you know, there's a time to back down. And, or just to do the responsible thing and say, I'm sure when the facts emerge, he will be exonerated. Or maybe not, you know? Like, and in every one of these cases, there was this huge of this kind of embedded character. There's this everyone getting really indignant, saying like, I've known him for 22 years. He's delivered my mail. I'm like, but have you been in his house? He's got people's parts and jars. So, yeah, I find that, like, yeah, defending the pedophile, kind of like those people, you know, like defending the guy, body parts and jars.
But at the same time, people who take that stance, it's that they're defending themselves. It's like, you know, because the real question is, like, how could your brethren have, like, people's bits in a freezer and you don't know? Like, so they're, in a sense, they're defending themselves.
Right. I mean,
you know, and people who, you know, you support this person, you've bought all their books, and you find out, oh my gosh, this person's into this stuff. It's like, that can't be, you know, denial.
Right.
Denial.
And you have, I mean, again, the characters that we might find it more troublesome with is, it's also like pedophilia in many cases is a socially defined crime, right? Like it's defined in terms of our relative notions of adulthood and childhood and like the construction of the ideal of a child and a childhood and stuff like that. But it seems to be one of the areas in which, at least in societies like the one we're living in right now, we're fairly comfortable drawing the line and drawing it pretty hard and saying that, yes, this is like this is a line you don't cross. And
I mean, it does. There, I think our society definitely sends mixed messages about that, because you do see in media and in quote unquote responsible sources like the overt sexualization of children. And it's a huge problem. And
absolutely,
it's one of those things we tend not to talk about or we talk away. That said, responsible adults do know that looking at nudie child pictures is a bad thing, and it's not a huge infringement or shouldn't be a huge infringement on your personal freedoms to not look at them.
Right.
It was I watched a video of him kind of defending his stance, and it was just the kind of
what
like
what was his like defense?
Well, primarily that. It was
just
primarily
free
speech or personal liberty more than free speech.
Right.
You know, and it was like, wow, like, what is the limit on that to a degree? You know, and the anti-censorship or whatever.
Right. And the standards are very different the world over. And like in Europe, for example, the primary standard is going to be based on human dignity. And so it's a violation of human dignity. And so free speech is not a hard and fast category. In the U.S., free speech trumps almost everything, right? So we'll have certain things like child pornography rings and things like that, which will get busted because it crosses the free speech line. And the kind of story you always hear is the yelling fire in a crowded theater and things like that. Like, that crosses the free speech line. But then free speech kind of, especially last year, is kind of facing a lot of redefinition as well. So there was a guy in Massachusetts who got convicted in a federal court for translating documents by fundamentalist Muslim organizations. He didn't write them. He just translated them from Arabic or Urdu or whatever other languages he was dealing in into English, because he thought that the critique that they were offering of militarism and things like that was worth being read. And so he was convicted of aiding terrorism. And that's all he did, was he just translated. And so in that case, that is the limit of free speech. And free speech traditionally has always been restricted to certain people, like people in the army. It's been restricted to people in private institutions, so non-public institutions. So at a private school, you don't have free speech in the U.S. There's a bubble that's created by that. And free speech. So there are limits that even advocates for First Amendment rights will say that, yeah, free speech does have its limits. But then if you're going to argue against its limits on something like child pornography, you're being a provocateur, and that you're just trying to get your name out there or pick an issue, and people will get you on news shows, people will talk to you. Again, I think it's a commercial move.
Oh, well,
it's a savvy move.
We'll see what happens. I would imagine. I would hope not. But nothing surprises me anymore. One thing that definitely doesn't surprise me was something I saw, like, you know, one of those like breaking news from Water is Wet, Sky is Blue news source. Imprisonment of Indigenous and African youth in Canada. You know, talking about those two groups are overrepresented, and it's kind of like. Really?
Yeah.
That's couldn't new. Imagine.
So was it a report?
It's a special investigation by the Star, I think it was, in a report. But
one of those spreads, yeah.
Certainly. And it's like, it's the fact that it would even be a story to a degree is something that I find interesting. Because I guess to some extent, I mean, it speaks to a certain detachment. I guess of the Star readership or us in general as to what's happening around incarceration and the politics of incarceration in this place. I've been in courtrooms and I've been in the system a bit, and I've seen like that's where we are. You know, like if you want to find people, that's where they are. If you haven't, you know, like there was a joke. It's like if you haven't seen a certain like brother for a while. He's probably in the bucket, you know, like one of those kind of things. It's a bit of a joke, not exactly, you know. So I remember hearing that from a long time, and then to hear this, you know, breaking news, you know, it's kind of like.
It's like,
I like the fact you called it Sky Blue, Rainy Sky kind of story.
Sky Blue, Water Wet News.
Water Wet News. Oh, wow. It's sort of. It's another way of desensitizing us in a certain way to these kind of key issues as well, is that they get reported ad nauseum in many cases, right? Mm. So you had those cases with 2 or 3 years ago, which with the Somali became synonymous with drug dealer. Mm. And it just by stressing that over and over in the press, that you create a kind of this culture of certain nervousness or fear or apprehension about dealing with these people. And I find that really troublesome, because it's sort of I think when you've got the media simultaneously engaging in alarmist tactics while needing to sell papers and things at the same time, it really makes me unhappy, because like, what are people taking from those kind of articles and those reports? Are they saying then, inherently that these populations are more violent, more dangerous, or that we have a social system that's seriously flawed that's maybe targeting people like this? Or are they saying, we are justified in doing what we're doing, and this is the way of re-educating persons of the system, like let's fall through, is that you put them through Khan College. And and I think it's part of it is that these are systemic problems, and the way even our prison system is, it's not if you want to change people in prison, you have to empower them. You have to train them in skills. You have to give them something to leave with. Mm-hmm. And if it's just merely a place which you're on an indefinite timeout with drugs and violence, like, how is that helping anybody?
So, well, if you own the jails, that helps you.
Yeah, especially with companies like Sodexo and other ones who are involved in a commercialized prison system. It's ridiculous. And not only that, but a lot of cafeterias at universities and things are owned by the same companies that are running corporate prisons. That's just,
The connections are really – it's not what you would immediately expect. It's not how things look on the surface. My concern with some of these stories is like the drift, where it starts with, oh, my gosh, this is so horrible. And then it kind of turns into, well, this is kind of what happened. And it turns into, well, this happens because these people are actually – like this, mm-hmm. you know, is it going to be one of those kind of like either drift or exhaustion type strategies? And what is the response? You know, so this is happening. Okay, now what?
Right.
You know, and oftentimes these types of reports or stories, they don't really get to that. It's usually just, oh my gosh, can you really believe this is happening? Well, yeah, I can believe it's happening.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, can you believe this is happening? And then they move on to the next story when something else happens. So it's kind of like...
And there's never follow-up. There's never like...
Rarely, you know, almost never. And so the question is, I mean, and maybe it's not the newspaper's job to do that, but it's kind of like for people who know that this is happening, then okay, now what?
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's a lot of it is, again, this refusal to think in a sort of systemic sense as to why these issues are taking place. Because I remember I was at a very strange party a few months ago, and I was surrounded by people who were primarily from immigrant stock and who were doing fairly well, like who had kind of gone to college, gotten jobs. And all of these people were like fairly well-adjusted, happy, kind of like earning young professionals. And I started raising the issues about how we need to sort of give back, be more aware of things like read. And a lot of them are like, well, why should I give to anyone else because I made it on my own? And that is like the biggest lie of all, right? Like Obama even got in trouble in the last election because he had said something to that effect in his first campaign. He's like, no one who's wealthy made it there on their own steam. Mm-hmm. And it's basically, unless you're a prospector and finding gold, it's pretty rare that you will like make it entirely on your own steam, because chances are that you've had to step on some backs and you've had to climb up that system taking advantage of the way it is because of a certain location or a certain availability or even the right to education, being educated. Like what a powerful blessing that can be, but it's only afforded by a very small portion of the population. Mm-hmm. And yet these people are all educated and none of them can think systemically in terms of like, well, what did my education cost? You know, what were the real costs? What were about the like, okay, so if I'm one Pakistani family that made it, how many of my compatriots, other people like me, didn't? Like how many of their kids got caught up in violence? How many of their kids? And, you know, and they know these stories, but they just don't make these connections because they don't
connect it to them. Yeah.
Or how it affects them, or how it speaks to their experience.
Yeah, and it takes a little shine off the success too, right? I mean, the immigrant success story is a real trope that's been handed down for the last 150 years in America.
That's why people emigrate, right?
And so it's supposed to fit in, you know, this it's supposed to fit a particular way, and it's like, you know, it's one of those like the myth of the meritocracy, like, you know, like by saying that I did this all by myself, I'm actually saying that I'm a really great person and I overcame all kinds of odds. Yeah. And these people who didn't do it, there's something wrong with them. The system works, and well, yeah, I'm proof of it. Right? Yeah, I'm living proof. So it's really a kind of agreement to a large part, you know, of a kind of careerist politic where it's like, these are the things you say. Everybody knows it really happens in terms of how people tend to get ahead or stay ahead or whatever. Everybody knows it's oftentimes a pretty cutthroat game. But in terms of securing your personal victory, these are the things you say. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, the more people are confronted with information to the contrary,
like our friend Tom Flanagan here, they're just going to dig in and try to either maintain their line or just kind of continue.
It also acts as like sort of this veil over the, you know, class structure, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like that illusion where you can move up, you can move. You know what I mean? There's a mobility there.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And it's just it kind of hurts me when I see people making those arguments, because it's often taped onto stories of very real perseverance, right? Like, so in their family, they're like, my dad worked his fingers to the bone. He worked two jobs. He made it. He made sure he could afford an education for me. And I'm like, that's really amazing. Like, the ethic that is instilled in your family is awesome. And like, I'm really glad that you've made it and that you're successful. But then why are you turning around and belittling other people who are also trying to make it, or saying that, you know, what we really need is to have my taxes drop a little bit, because I don't care about school kids because I don't have any kids.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well.
Well, like, the unfortunate part of class advancement is ladder kicking, right? It's like.
Yeah.
How do I make sure I maintain my privilege? Yeah, like, I mean, I remember hearing stories about people, you know, who made it, like in the Caribbean, and they said, yeah, I made it, and my job is to make sure nobody else does. Like, straight like that, like, straight. No one else is coming behind me. I'll be the first and the last, you know? And that's an extreme case, but it's kind of a bit of the psychology of it. And it's like, I've done so much to get here. I'm going to make sure I stay here and I enjoy all that I can enjoy now that I got here. So if you're coming to get some of this, well, guess what?
Yeah.
You know, we're going to make the climb that much steeper for you. And that's just part of the mentality of class preservation, you know,
right. Unfortunately.
Right.
So when I hear those types of responses, oftentimes it's coming from that place. You know, there might be other things going on to maybe mitigate that, or because people are often, you know, complex, but that is, I think anyway, that's where that typically comes from.
Yeah. But you're so right, Melinda, that we've just forgotten how to talk about class. And it's because I think it's tied up with this belief that the Cold War was won, that it was won by capitalism. It was won by Western democratic systems. And it wasn't. Just a bad system collapsed. You didn't win. It just sort of you lasted longer, and now you're seeing your system is collapsing
slowly. It's like two spent swimmers, right? It's like one drowns first, and the second's like, I win, but it's like you're nowhere near the shore.
Yeah,
you're gonna drown soon.
It's like, yeah, it's not looking so good, you know.
And the kind of reforms that were necessary in our systems here, the kind of narrow thinking, which has got sort of fleets deployed all over the world, and people like the Canadian militarization. It blows my mind as well. This desire to have more guns, and it sometimes when I see that, I'm like, there's entirely too many men in politics. And so,
well, I mean, that could bring us to Mali. Like, that's a situation that just seems like, you know, like a real, you know, Gerald was saying this morning, it's a real quagmire. Like, there's so many different interests involved.
Yeah.
And it's clearly one thing and it's clearly not that thing, it seems to me, if I can be any more vague.
Mm.
You know, but it's kind of like, it's very much an imperialistic type thing. But the alliances are not immediately what we would expect them to be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it takes strange bedfellows, like the fact that the Tea Party was being financed, endorsed by poor people. That just really blew my mind. I was like, so the reduction in taxes is going to result in you paying like $50 less a year, and that guy paying $100,000 less a year, and it's a good deal to you somehow. Because that $100,000 you are going to see more of the benefits of in the long run, especially if you have socialized healthcare or something. And I was once tried to explain this to an older man in Georgia, and he told me, I'm no damn red. And I was like, okay, well, that's Cold War politics. That's your education that kind of just still sticks.
Well, I mean, I think part of the story is that a lot of people think that they're going to be that person who'll be saving $100,000 you know, off the tax cut one day.
Someday.
Someday that's going to be me. So,
and then it goes back to the ladder climbing. I'm moving up, so.
Well, yeah, that's going to be me one day. So I wouldn't want that to happen to me. That's who I'm going to be. And so, yeah, I support that. Even though in my immediate circumstance, it doesn't immediately help me. But I don't really plan to be here much longer. So, great.
Right. You know?
I think that's some of the thinking around that. And, like, it is. It's we've really, in the West, been able to disappear class, you know, thinking about class and how class plays out in identity beyond the simple income or this, like, or this person went to that school or that school, just beyond the mere advantage of it. But like, how do people think to maintain these constructs, these social constructs, you know, of class? And it's huge. But then what I think also keeps that discussion at bay is the very idea that one day I'm going to make it. So I don't really want to get into this conversation because I might be complicating my own future.
Yeah. And you don't hear in conversation in the same way that I think socialism had a lot of sway in places like in Europe and the student movements in the 60s and the 70s, and you don't see that as much here. It started with the Occupy movement. People were discussing class again, and it was kind of coming up for the first time in a long time. And Canada's always had a slightly more vibrant conversation around that than the United States. But disappearing the class conversation is a very bad idea, because I think also that it makes your terms of conversation kind of different then, because then you start talking about immigrants, you start talking about race, and you base your conversations around issues like that. Like, I personally have a bit of an issue with the way that affirmative action systems have been shaped in the U.S. because I grew up I spent the last 2 years of my high school in a particularly wealthy area in New Jersey, where there were where like Lauryn Hill went to school and stuff like that. And a lot of these kids were taking advantage of affirmative action grants to get in, they would be at a preferential treatment to get into certain schools. And these were kids whose parents were driving like Porsches and stuff. And yet there would be the same school district that I was in included Newark. And those kids weren't going to get the same advantages, because even if they got preferential treatment to get into a school, they couldn't afford it.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying it's like still on class lines anyway.
Yeah. And so why isn't it being based entirely on poverty?
Right.
Like, why isn't affirmative action 100% designed at poverty? You will hit the target populations anyway.
Right.
Like, you don't need to ask a person's race. All you have to do is look to see how much money was coming into that house, and you'll know where these people fit. And how hard it was for them.
Like,
I think the making it a racial issue, it makes it ridiculous. Like, why is the poor Polish immigrant being treated the same way as not being treated the same way as someone who's poor in Newark, in the ghetto, in the Hispanic ghettos in Newark or something like that, you know? So.
Yeah, so we kind of need like a class affirmative action.
Absolutely.
A class sensitive.
Yeah.
And that, I feel, is the that to me, I guess, because I grew up with very class conscious, that when I came to America, that seemed like the real disconnect here. I was like, why isn't this a class conversation? Why is this about race? Like, why does every form I fill out ask me my race? And then I thought that was very, very, very strange. Well, so.
I think in LA, in California, they've been able to do that a little bit in terms of, including a class factor and income factor in terms of their other kinds of affirmative action considerations. But it's very much true. I mean, the idea behind affirmative action is to help a group that's been disadvantaged via discrimination that has had profound class effects. So to not make it about class directly, or at least have like that as one of the variables in it, you'd be missing a whole swath of the population who actually needs that, actually needs those considerations, and giving them to some people who particularly don't.
Yeah.
And it's just like, especially with things like college education, access to an education is just, it's so critical. And to make it into something that's commodified in the way that it is, like looking at some of the costs of going to school in the U.S., like $50,000, $60,000 now to to go to a 4-year liberal arts college. So this kid's going to graduate with no like marketable skills to be able to go get a job. And yet where is that money going to come from? And how is that person going to pay that back? And I think a liberal arts education is critical to the building of good citizens. But at the same time, how can you expect people to pay 50 grand a year to get a liberal arts education?
I mean, there's been some talks about discouraging that kind of that type of learning or having it focused on, you know, liberal arts for that very reason. Right? The idea is, you know, what is it gonna accomplish? How does it actually help society? And like you did answer the question to a degree where it's like, well, yeah, it helps you be aware of history and how societies have functioned in the past. It's very important. But in terms of this actually creating a skilled young population, you know, like being versed in Chaucer isn't really going to do a whole lot for you in that regard.
And do you have to go to a lecture to do that? I mean, if so-called the, you know, your other, you've been taught to actually read and write, hopefully. Mm-hmm. It's something that you can kind of, you don't need to pay or go to a lecture to actually engage with if you are properly educated.
Yeah, there's a lot of projects that have been launched now about open universities, free university classes and things that you can take online. There's professors even offering their time. Like UofT is part of a group of schools as well, which has gotten involved in this.
Yeah, Harvard, I think. Mm-hmm. They're all online, yeah.
Yeah, courses that you can take, and some of them even you can do your homework and send it, and the professor is volunteering their time completely to grade and do all of that extra work because they believe in these projects. And I think that is amazing. And the open university model is something that's just but again, the gatekeeping on that is now going to be, do you have internet access? Do you have like the language competencies? And so, sure, you're going to be you can do this from the comfort of your own home. But if your home's not particularly comfortable, then like, how is that going to happen for you?
Yeah. So,
but it's a step in the right direction because, I mean, you can go to a public library, you can access a system, and you can attend your classes. And you can you don't have to go into that standard lecture model, but at the same time, like you can take a course from a professor at Yale and on English and not have to like pay for that in pay for that direct course separately. And I think those things are great. Like I actually have started taking one.
What did you say?
Oh, I want to learn to program.
Oh, I want to do that too.
Everybody does, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to have an idea of what's going on. Actually, it's just something that I'm always a bit nervous about is when I ask someone to do something for me and they're like, look, I did it, just no problem. And I'm like, but how? And it's kind of like I feel like an idiot when I go to a mechanic or something in the same way. I just want them to explain to me what's happening. And I want to have enough of the tool that I can understand whatever language they're speaking or what have you.
Yeah, so you can follow along at least.
Yeah.
Like I had my bike maintained recently and the guy was like, well, we did this, and I was like, okay, well, what I need you to explain a bit better because I would like to understand what was done. And then the guy's like, and I was like, yeah, well, I'm not paying this bill unless I have an idea because
but you actually did.
Yeah. Because I like a sense of, especially with something mechanical, because just definitionally, right? Like it has to do with something that's simple to understand because it's mechanics that you can like touch and play with it and understand it. So,
But I remember hearing all the time growing up is you pay for what you don't know, right? You pay for what you don't know. And like if you apply that to the idea of job creation and then the idea of like creating certain ignorances, right? It's like that's how you almost guarantee fields of work, right? That's how you maintain future work.
It's like, it's also like specialization too, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, between those things. So it's like sometimes the gaps in that we have in our learning to a degree, it's like that's what's keeping hundreds of thousands of people employed.
Yeah,
you know, and it's written in there. It's not exactly an accident, but I definitely feel this. You know, on the flip side of that is how do you counter that? Is that you try to be knowledgeable as much as you can and be able to do things. And I look at this situation with education where it's going down, and it's almost like It's like how it's money politics, is right? How people with money can just basically just lean on you to a degree. So they don't have to directly say, don't take a liberal arts education. Things will just happen to be arranged so that taking a liberal arts education isn't going to really give you any kind of advantage, and it's going to cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so you're going to come to the conclusion that, well, maybe this isn't as useful as being able to code or whatever the case is, or have a real actual marketable skill, which I think is good. And another side is, you know, it's a little bit, I guess, nefarious the way that the whole thing kind of goes down, and how costly it is, you know, where it could be done in a lot more democratic and a way that's not as expensive to regular people.
Yeah, and it's definitely like sort of like this, the way you can see how capitalism is like embedded in our education system. Right?
Oh yeah, huge.
Because
right.
you're funneling people into certain work fields. And
right. And when, but I really feel sad when my students ask me, they're like, so do you think I'll be able to get a job when I graduate? And my response is usually like, no. And not only that, but if you had a friend who didn't go to school and has just been working since they graduated high school or what have you, like that person has 4 years of work experience, and like here you are graduating with nothing. Like, so
good luck with that.
Yeah, like that. Glad you read that queer theory, but we're gonna help you. but at the same time, I feel it's so important for them to have a sense of these things, right? Like, I'm involved in the production of knowledge, so I have a vested interest in encouraging people to take my classes. But then if they ask me, is it going to get me a job? I'm like, no, but it may make you respect your neighbor. So, like, that's important too, I think. Just quantified differently.
Yeah, 60 grand worth.
Honestly, I just, as someone on the knowledge production side, I feel that I deserve a reasonable salary for the kind of job I do. And I think I do a really good job. And so I feel that I should be able to earn a living wage for that. And I should be able to, like, maintain a house and things like that and not feel exploited by a system. And many times universities are, skewed towards a research model. And research models in the arts and sciences are going to be more about just producing, conversations which aren't going to be accessible to common people, right? Like in no meaningful way. Mm. But the teaching aspect is usually downplayed a great deal. But when you get to a small liberal arts college, then it's all about teaching. And that was like one of the lessons that I've gotten by like being in both spaces. Is being in the big university, they're turning into factories. Whereas the small liberal arts college has still got a bit of the culture of the college about it. So
yeah, I think that's in. I still, I guess I'm a little bit of a nostalgist in that way. I still think that some of that stuff is useful. It's just been really interesting to see how the institution has adapted or quote-unquote evolved. You know, when you have this rush of people who are trying to get qualified, that's when it suddenly becomes useless, right? Like, or not what it was once worth, you know? And it's just a very interesting dynamic how that just kind of that all played out so neatly and quickly. Over the space of, you know, basically in Ontario anyway, at least 10 years. And it's similar things are happening in the States, you know.
Okay, so we're running out of time.
Look at that.
It's already, we're reaching the end of our hour. And I would like to thank our tech who came in, Sean.
Thank you.
And this is The Vibe Collective, and you're listening to CIUT 89.5. And we're going to go to a mix, and it's a DJ Jams mix. And yeah, so enjoy.
Would you like to be the exclusive sponsor of this hour of CIUT programming? Support community radio and get your business recognized. Go to www.ciut.fm to find out how you can sponsor an hour of CIUT programming for just $30.
Decisive.
Resilient.
Compassionate. The qualities of a successful physician, the definition of a Ross graduate. Ross University School of Medicine is looking for students with these qualities and the calling to become a physician. We have a strong alumni network of over 9,000 physicians practicing across the U.S. and Canada, including Vanessa Doyle, who attained a competitive neurology residency at a renowned Ottawa teaching hospital in 2012. Come meet our alumni at the Toronto Information Seminar, Saturday, March 9th at 2 p.m. To register, visit rossu.edu.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.